This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What is... Dax, are you...
tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Take me out to the ball game.
What are you doing?
Did you know DirecTV has the most MLB games?
So you're singing?
Yeah, they put your favorite teams front and center right when you turn it on. Buy me some cold cuts and flapjacks.
Those aren't even the words.
I'm allergic to peanuts.
Stream DirecTV, home of the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks. RSNs available with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Dan, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we appreciate it, and we loved your work. That story was fantastic. Coupled with John Greenberg's story, I think that Sox fans were very excited and thrilled to learn that Justin Ishbia is becoming more of an investor. And I think the thing we've been talking about is that, you know, I get it that Jerry doesn't have to sell the team, but if he's halfway down the road with the Polans to get the Twins, that's got to be a shock that he pulls out and now suddenly is in pursuit of the White Sox one way or another, in my opinion.
Right. And look, I think that's the part that we have to add the context to, right, is obviously the White Sox said there's no deal to power in place that lets him take control. But this is a guy that everybody around the league, people within the Twins, people handling the sale, we're talking about the Twins deal being closed by opening day. Or not closed, sorry, they were going to pick the winning bidder by opening day. That was about January 10th. I mean, talking to people, they were super confident that this was going to be done and that there was a really good market for Twins ownership in place. As of last week, the messaging has changed. And now it's, well, we're going to have resolution one way or another in 30 to 60 days. And technically, that does still include opening day. But the market went from robust to adequate. And every intent, everything that we're hearing is that it's because Justin Ishbia pulled out. And look, when I told, I will say Twins people at camp are definitely far removed from this because there's a capital market company in New York handling the sale. It's just like a realtor handling your house sale, except, you know, with billions instead of hundreds of thousands. But they were shocked. They all expected, they had done their own homework on Justin Ishbia because the league had vetted them on behalf of the Twins. The Twins had started vetting him on their own. He had made all kinds of inroads with community leaders, reaching out to former players about getting into ownership group. It was well believed that he was coming to the Twins because he wants a team in the worst way. And, you know, so when you do the math, I mean, clearly he thinks that he's going to have a shot at the White Sox to switch at such a late stage, I would say. I mean, apparently there cannot be handshake deals when banks are involved. But, you know, there's got to be something there that made him stop this pursuit of the Twins. Because, look, Twins are in good shape They don't have a lot of cost. They have a ballpark that's 15 years old. That's a gem. It's, you know, in a division that you can very easily be a competitor every 2 to 3 years just because nobody's spending gobs of cash. So it's a good spot. And there's a lot of potential for growth in ticket sales there. It's a good investment. You can see it, something that people would look at it and go, yeah, I like this team. But when you compare it to the White Sox, if the White Sox get a new stadium and what that franchise valuation is going to go to from where it is, I think the word is that he's buying in at 1.8 and buying the minority shares at $1.8 billion. Look, if the White Sox ever get that stadium and become a destination where, similar to Wrigley, people just show up even if the White Sox are terrible because they know there's great music and bars and stuff like that, restaurants and you know, hotels around the stadium. If the White Sox ever get that, you know, you chip a little bit away at that Cubs huge market in that regard. I mean, come on, we've been to Wrigley where it's 35,000 and the Cubs are 10 games out. It happens all the time. And you know, I think the White Sox have some dreams of that, of achieving something like that. And I could see long-term why you would look at the two, the two franchises and say, yeah, I want the White Sox one. Not, you know, not to mention the whole Winnetka and the big house. And, you know, I mean,
right. So if that's the case and he wants to run his own team and he's far afield and all that's missing is, you know, it becomes a formality. And he, all the things that you just said are true, but who got to him then? How did it go from,
right,
we're about to close a deal in Minnesota to we're going to pivot here and go in this direction? What happened and who got involved?
Yeah, so we I wrote about Ishbia being a Twins candidate in December, and it just got stronger from there, right? I mean, he was publicly named. People confirmed it. You know, he's doing all those meetings with the community leaders. John Greenberg's part of the reporting, and it's a big one, was that, you know, after he was tied into the Twins, that the Reinsdorfs reached out and said, hey, let's talk some more. And that was in January. And I heard from people tied into the Twin sale process that they heard about that about a month ago. And I think they knew that it was definitely a possibility that he would not be interested at that point. And honestly, you know, I mean, he's already invested in the White Sox. He's building, you know, the number keeps getting bigger on the rumored size of his mansion. I think I saw at first it was $70 million, and today I think John Greenberg wrote that it's $80 million. So soon it'll be like $150 million, right? We're just gonna keep adding to it. Maybe that's where he'll sell the land to Jerry and they can move the ballpark there.
to his house.
You know, I mean, I think once the, you know, John wrote that the Reinsdorfs reach out, and I honestly, ball game over at that point, just because if there's some kind of way for him to be in charge of the White Sox, that's clearly what he wanted.
You know the Sox, you've covered the Sox, you know Jerry. And he's 89 today, and we've wished him happy birthday many times. He loves being the Sox owner, and he loves smoking a cigar and watching the team, and he does it in Glendale and he does it in Chicago. I'm just curious, do you believe that he is concerned about the future, his legacy, you know, the fact that they had the worst season in modern baseball history? Does that bother him? Does that impact him? And is he willing to kind of give up his interest if indeed that is what's required?
Yeah, I don't think he wants the team to leave Chicago. And look, he's had two sort of attempts the last 2 years, right, to get some groundswell, to get the stadium going, and the Nashville thing that came out in October with Dave Stewart, and the year before that where they were talking about leaving. I think he very much wants the legacy to be kind of, you know, cemented. They won, right? They were the first team to win in Chicago. They beat the Cubs, even though the national news likes to forget 2005 occasionally and overlook it. You know, I remember in 2016, the last time a Chicago team won, and, you know, they just leave the White Sox out. They won, and they've been a good franchise at times. I think he would love for them to be there. But you're right. He loves owning a team. He loves being in baseball. And the quotes say it all. You know, what else would I do? I don't think he's going anywhere anytime soon. And I think he's a private guy when it comes to a lot of the business dealings. And I think that, you know, there's putting a time, a countdown on this is not going to do him any favors. Like if there was a announced path for Ishbia to take control of the team, then fans are going to be, I mean, fans are going to be clamoring for that anyways. But at the same time, if it was like 2 years from now, fans are just going to get disgruntled. And I mean, there is going to be a waiting game involved here. Clearly, you know, this is not something that is going to be overnight. But, you know, I can understand why. And I think that, you know, what if some of this money goes towards helping them get that stadium? Because, again, I think that's the goal, is having something that people want to go to. And even if the team is, you know, 500, that they have it as a destination to go for a weekend or even just a night and come out and hang out. That's something they've never had. And, you know, I think that we've seen teams around the league do that. Atlanta, Texas, the Cardinals, they all have it. They have their, you know, it's like Texas Live, and I don't know what St. Louis is called, but, you know, there's a bunch of fans that have places to spend their money after the game. Atlanta's Battery has like 3 hotels, multiple restaurants. It's a cool way to do something and put it in a spot where fans will go and park and spend their money. And I mean, Wrigleyville is like the original model, right? Like, even though that was just organically done, Wrigleyville is the ideal part, and they're in the same city. And I just think that, you know, there's motivation on both sides here, without question.
So just before we let you go, Dan, in your view, based on your reporting and knowing Jerry Reinsdorf, who doesn't obviously say a lot publicly about this and certainly wouldn't start now, but do you believe, based on all that you know, that he welcomes this involvement from Justin Ishbia and in some ways might even be helping to pave the way for him to one day take over?
I will honestly say I don't know. John did a lot of the White Sox reporting on this. I'm just, you know, the math just makes it seem that way. I mean, look, this guy wants a team. He's motivated by a team. He definitely has the financial wherewithal. And when you think about all those things and that he could have had a really good product and owned it, you know, by May when all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, you know, I just think there's got to be something there that's a lot further cemented. And I know that John reported it, and, you know, the White Sox declined the part where there's any kind of deal in place. But, I mean, they're going to do that. That's just, they don't want that countdown, but I have to think that's in place.
Okay, John. John's reporting was really interesting. When you look at the idea that the White Sox could, I mean, how quickly would that impact spending on the payroll? We've seen them kind of turn back a little bit, and they are not spending the money they did. I want to say their cap's down to like $82 million or something, where it was over, yeah, it was crazy last year that they spent as much money as they did and they lost. How would that impact, how would a change impact that?
Yeah, look, I think John wrote it today that it would be probably something, one development we could see is if they allowed Justin Ishbia onto the Sox Board of Governors.
Right,
You know, if that was to happen, you could see him have some influence for sure. But this is Jerry's team. It's always been Jerry's team, and he runs it. And, you know, the losses have definitely been tremendous. I 2 years, you know, they were loaded for bear a few years ago with that great team. And fans didn't come, and attendance fell off hard. And, I mean, to be down to like 1.3 million last year. And we know it's going to be worse than that this year, because on paper, this is a worse team at this point, right? That's the development I want to see. And then I would think that, you know, Justin Ishbia is on that board of governors and has some say. Like, that's a young voice in there that they need. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because clearly the Sox are going to keep saying what they're saying, and it's understandable why they're saying it. I think to sell the team stuff, it's funny how much the Twins and the White Sox are parallel in all of this, because Twins fans were saying sell the team last year. The Pollad family has owned them since 1984. You know, they won the two World Series, but they've always had low payrolls. Fans are tired of it. And that is probably the craziest part about all of this, is just the power swing here in the division. Because talking to guys, you know, Justin Morneau played for both teams, right? And we were talking about the other day, he said, if that's true, that's terrible for the Twins, that this guy with the deep pockets potentially could go from helping us become waking a little bit of a sleeping giant, because the Twins have sold 3 million tickets 3 times. They have that potential to bring in a ton of fans. That's like $55 million in revenue, and maybe even more annually if they could go from 1.9 million to 3 million. Now he's going to the White Sox to wake up a potential sleeping giant. I mean, just what the impact this could have on the division long term is pretty incredible.
Thanks so much, Dan. Great stuff. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, guys.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover, all for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code FLEX at checkout. That's harrys.com, code FLEX. Enjoy.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
StreetEasy knows former New Yorkers never stop talking about how much they miss living in NYC.
Life used to feel like a movie, but since we left and bought a house, it's like living in a DIY home repair video.
When it's time to buy, let StreetEasy connect you with the right agent you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. StreetEasy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you believe you were wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
All right, thanks.
The stumble bum play that you hit the Bears with.
Did you like that one?
You like that?
It was clever.
You like that?
Right now, Jason Leisure, Dan Wiederer, they're just sharpening knives.
Jason Leisure.
I am entertained by your questioning at Ellis Hall, like a lot of people.
Oh,
that
you are entertained by my questions?
Well, yes, I'm entertained by them because they're good questions. So, what do you mean I'm entertaining?
Funny how? I mean, what's funny about it?
Tommy, no, you got it all wrong.
Oh, Anthony.
He's a big boy. He knows what he said. What'd you say?
How am I entertaining? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Funny.
Get the
hell out of here with this entertainment crap.
Yeah, entertaining like a clown.
Entertainment stuff.
I almost had him. Frankie, was he shaking? I wonder about you sometimes, Henry. You may fold under questioning.
There's reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times.
I talk about the draft on the clock for a week. No support from anybody here at the station. Shane Reardon hates the show,
yeah.
Jason, but I wanted to make you aware of that so you know okay. What we're joshing about here.
Well, that probably means it's good if Shane hates it.
Jason Leisure with Spiegel and Holmes on 670 The Score.
Jason Leisure, he of the Sun-Times. I saw him in pictures. It was great because everybody was posting pictures, Anthony Heron from the Combine, and they were like, here's the crowd at the Combine. So then you get one angle, and that showed you like half of the Bears media. And then somebody else would post a picture, they're like, here's the Combine, and they'd show the other. And I was like, together, I figured out who's there.
I respect the kinship of the Bears media out there just shouting each other out, posting each other on social. It's nice.
Yeah, you know who's asking the questions, and one of them was our friend Jason Leisure. And Jason, you joined at an interesting time because Anthony Heron is also mixing in Combine stories, having been a player and objectified by everybody in the NFL. What do you think?
What do I think about that?
Yeah, I mean, just the aspect of, like, are there any questions you have for somebody who's had to stand in front of people in his underwear before for work? Like, do you have any questions?
Do you ever get used to it? I mean, it's the start of having to do it all the time because you end up doing your interview in your underwear, too. I mean, do you ever get used to that?
It is an odd experience. It certainly is. And it's grown and evolved over the years. Like, you know, you guys get to be there now. There's a crowd in the stands and the players are running and everything else. But, you know, when you're in the locker room and, you know, maybe you got a towel on, maybe you're running in the shower and doing all that kind of stuff, that it never is not awkward, but you, I guess, appreciate and respect the awkwardness at a certain point of those post-game locker room and post-practice locker room settings. But now at this point,
it's funny to me because I've done this for so long, and I've heard so many players complain over the years about, you know, we don't really want you guys coming in and asking us questions when we're in a towel or whatever. And I always tell them, like, yeah, I don't want to do that either. I wish there was some other way. It's not a hobby of mine to come up and try to talk to people while they're getting dressed.
Mm-hmm. And the combine itself, with the way that, you know, you guys have the potential to talk to whoever the future Bear is right now, how much of that is just the process you're going through? Like, last season we knew, let's all get our first glimpse at Caleb, and then everyone came away and said, oh, he's not a space alien. Yep. But at this point, with the Bears having the number 10 pick, are you kind of eyeballing the different prospects who are kind of roaming around Indy in a different way this week?
Yeah, you had that intrigue last year because you didn't know what they were going to do at number 9. But, hey, by the way, since you brought it up last year with Caleb Williams and finding out that he's not a space alien, how much different has this guy turned out to be as a person and a personality type than everything you heard this time last year?
Well, I feel like that's just the process of the combine. Like, you're on a roller coaster during the off season. You fall in love with everybody at the Senior Bowl and wherever else, you know, East-West Shrine Bowl. And then you have to convince yourself you made the wrong decision in falling in love with them at the combine and right before the draft. And then somewhere around the draft, you actually get honesty. And that's the part of it that I laugh about is this just process of hyping yourself up only to then get mad at yourself to then trust yourself. So I don't blame Caleb Williams at all, and I never did, for wanting to be a part of it when he had enough tape to prove who he was. I always applauded him for not being a part of the combine process. But you're right, Jason, it's just a total, like, drag the people down who got into the position to be the highest at the combine, which does not make sense to me.
Yeah, to Ant's point and his question about the combine and everything like that, you know, it must be nice to be Caleb Williams or to be Cam Ward this year, who has the leverage basically to say, no, you know what, I don't really want to do all that. I mean, Cam Ward doesn't have it like Caleb Williams did. Caleb Williams wouldn't even do medicals at the combine because why? Why would I do medicals for 32 teams when I'm almost certain I'm going to go number one, whether it's to the Bears or whoever trades with the Bears? But this is for teams. It's usually the starting point on this is oftentimes the first time that the GM, the coach, the top decision makers in any organization actually meet the top prospects. You study them on film for years in some cases, and then this is the starting point on confirming what kind of person you're going to get and whether this is somebody you think you can work with. But it's only the start. I mean, there are so many more things to go here in the process, particularly you're going to have a much longer conversation with these guys when you go to their pro days, and even more so when you host them at Halas Hall for a pre-draft visit.
Yeah, that's the part to me that matters as well, as you actually talking to them. It's kind of like when Ben Johnson said today, I do want to get your takeaways from what he and Ryan Poles said, when he said he was watching the film and you learn a lot now because you actually have some background on the players. It's not just watching the film. It's finding out football intelligence and those things as well. I thought that was a very key point he made. What were your takeaways from what those guys said?
First off, I don't know if you guys already covered this, but Mark Grody was the unintentional star of Ryan Poles' press conference because he was standing right behind him the whole time. So you're watching everything Ryan Poles says. You're watching Grody's face to see if he reacts to it.
You guys know Grody's pulling this on purpose now, right? Because he's in a lot of the background shots here as of late. Have you guys started giving him a hard time for it?
A little bit. It would have been funnier. Like, that's a terrible place for me to be because I have no poker face. And you would see my reaction in my face to every question and every answer. I would have no friends in the media left after this, I'm sure of it. But the most interesting thing I took away from the combination of listening to Ryan Poles and Ben Johnson today was that, man, this, from a personnel standpoint, this is going to be so different than it ever was with Matt Eberflus. And Ben Johnson is supposed to be that. He's supposed to be an upgrade. You know that you want him based on the scheme and the offense they ran in Detroit. But I think he brings something to the table personnel-wise that Matt Eberflus never could. And you hear Ryan Poles say, that the IQ, the football IQ Ben Johnson has is, quote, different than what he's been around before. It's funny, different is like a diplomatic way of saying better in so many cases. Like somebody else at the Sun-Times or somebody else in the Chicago media might make, we don't want to say they make more money than me, but they make different money than me. Let's just say it's different. And then you have Ben Johnson saying that the amount of influence he has on personnel here is quote unquote different than it was in Detroit when he was just the offensive coordinator. So I think that he is having a much more significant voice in the personnel than Matt Eberflus. And it was really interesting when Ryan Poles was talking about Ben Johnson and Caleb Williams. One of the things I asked Ryan Poles was, well, what's your role in merging these two guys as Ben Johnson brings his style of offense to Caleb Williams' style of playing quarterback? And Ryan Poles' answer was basically, well, that's Ben's job. Ben's got the expertise. You know, that's on him to handle that. That is definitely different than it was last year.
With the roster itself, and one thing that I think in a couple of opportunities that you guys have had to address things with Ben Johnson, he seems to be, you know, talking in a really confident way about where he can take this team pretty quickly. But we've seen, you know, this sort of juxtaposition now of we're 3 years into Ryan Poles setting this roster up with his vision, and now Ben Johnson comes in to try and enhance the production of it, but we don't know how many tweaks will really be legitimate or plausible for them to make. And hearing from both of them today, and I feel like the question got asked to each of them in different ways at different times, but how close do they seem to think? How good of a roster do they seem to believe this is at the moment?
Yeah, I'm not sure how good they believe it is at the moment. I think they both believe it can be good. With $80 million in cap space and three really high draft picks. But that is unpredictable, especially the draft is unpredictable. You have somewhat of an idea now and in the next week or so, I think you'll have a better idea if you're the Bears of how to predict free agency and who's going to go where and who you really have a shot at. But the draft is totally unpredictable. You don't know who the teams in front of you will pick. You don't know who's going to trade into one of those spots. But Ben Johnson has been adamant about the idea that this team can be ready to compete this season. And even specifically, he was talking about the offensive line today and said, I don't think it's unrealistic to flip three or four starters for the 2025 season between free agency and the draft. The thing for me, the fastest path for them to be competitive in 2025 is Caleb Williams. That's the biggest wild card. So if he gets good quickly, then you will get good quickly. And you do that by putting him in, surrounding him with better coaching in terms of scheme and a playbook that maximizes his strength, but also coaching him to play the position and view the position better and quicker than the last staff did. And also giving him the ability to do that with a better offensive line in front of him. That just changes the whole game. I mean, that's one of the reasons why college quarterbacks who are really great struggle in the NFL is because, like Justin Fields from Ohio State, where he had this unbelievable all-American loaded offensive line, bought him time. And then you come to the NFL, it's like playing a different sport because of how fast it is. So if you fix the offensive line and you coach Caleb Williams better and he makes some strides in his offseason work, that's how you can get competitive quickly if you're the Bears.
Yeah, to me, that was a big part of what Ben Johnson had to say is you can tell he wanted something different on the line when he's talking about the combination of players. And he's like, it's finding the five guys who work. And then he said, it's not even just five, you know, because of injuries. It's 5, 6, 7, 8 guys. It's 5 to 10 guys. I think 10 was the number he ended at. And he referenced the bullpen, but you can tell that that was a big piece of the discussion for him as far as figuring out this team. The Bears have backed themselves into this. They backed themselves into moving from the outside in when it came to personnel acquisition. They have no choice but to improve the offensive and defensive lines now. And when Ryan Poles also said, Jason, that the supply will match the demand, I thought that that was interesting as well. I don't know if he was saying that specifically about the draft or if he was saying it as a combination of free agency and the draft. I know it was related to both in the answer. I don't know if you have more light on that one, but it was clear that that was something that must have been discussed in the 5 weeks since Johnson has been hired.
Well, Ryan Poles has been really consistent through his 3+ years now in wanting to match the appropriate resources with the positions you're addressing. So, for example, that first year where he does not have what would have been the number 5 pick in the draft because Ryan Pace had traded it, and he's got the 2 second-round picks. Well, you've got a lot of problems on that roster, but 2 second-round picks, you're not going to really be able to secure premium positions with those picks. Those are picks you could use to get a couple of guys in the secondary, like Kyler Gordon and Jaquan Brisker. Last year, when you're sitting there with the number 9 pick, that is a premium pick that you could use on a premium resource, like a defensive end or an offensive tackle. Wide receiver, one of those premium positions where, you know, that's, you want to be picking somebody in the top 10 if you're looking to address one of those positions for the long term. I think this year, you're drafting 10th as of now, unless they trade up or down, and you've got quarterback. And wide receiver, that can't be something you're doing with that pick right now. But at number 10, you can get a premium top-end defensive end or offensive tackle. So in the draft, that lines up. In free agency, it's a matter of having the money and seeing players who check the boxes to shell out for that. And you know, I'm not really sure if that's there at offensive tackle or pass rusher at the moment. It might become there. It might become available as guys become cap casualty cuts. But right now, I'm not sure about that. So you can only address the problems each year with the resources that you have. And this is a year where they've got one of those top 10 picks that they can address one of the top positions. And it makes so much sense to do that financially. Because if you're still being careful financially, which has been key to Ryan Poles' approach so far, a pass rusher or an offensive tackle that you draft at number 10 is cost you something like, I think, $6 to $8 million a year for 4 years. The top 10 guys at those positions are all in the 20 million plus salary range. So over the long haul, you're really saving a lot if you can find a guy at number 10 at pass rusher or offensive tackle who's going to be a star at that position quickly.
This question would be, I guess, a bit of housekeeping that will only matter if things go really awful for the Bears and really great for the Raiders. But I did see you tweeting and you wrote in the Sun-Times about, or for the Sun-Times.com, about Pete Carroll and his interest in the Bears. And one of the things that I was told by someone coming out of the Pete Carroll interview is that he felt like it went amazing and, you know, that he thought the Bears were going to be super interested. And then they never even gave him a second interview and they moved forward with Ben Johnson. So maybe it ends up making all the sense in the world, but maybe it won't. What were your takeaways just from hearing Pete Carroll at the podium today and what he said about his Bears opportunity that never came?
I wondered how serious he thought that was, because Ben Johnson was the obvious candidate for the Bears even before Matt Eberflus got fired. Ben Johnson was a guy that was being linked through the media to the Bears the year before when they had the opportunity where they could have moved on from Eberflus after going 7-10. But Pete was really serious about the opportunity, and Pete is not somebody I don't think that would have wanted to do a big rebuild at this stage in his career, which it looks like that's probably what he's going to have on his hands with the Raiders. But I wanted to know, really, what did he see Bears as he was trying to come back to the league? And it really was the opportunity that if you are the guy that turns the Bears around, then that cements your legacy in a way that it would if you're the guy that turned the Cubs around, like Theo Epstein, for example. And additionally, he liked the idea of having Caleb Williams at quarterback. He saw what the rest of the league sees in Caleb Williams. And I think in Chicago, you know, we're so close to the situation. So we know every little thing that goes well or goes wrong with Caleb Williams. I think the rest of the league is looking at that rookie season, which was up and down, and saying, well, we all still think he's going to be really, really good. And you see that by the fact that the Bears were able to get, you know, interviews with all the top candidates they wanted this past offseason.
Any other observations that maybe you haven't disclosed yet on this first day of the combine that you would like to share? Just things you've seen. You're an observant individual, as we know. So I know you sat in on Pete Carroll. Anything else that you think is worthy of discussion that you want to share?
Yeah, I talked to Sean Payton today with the Broncos about Declan Doyle, the offensive coordinator, and he said there was nothing about this that was surprising, that somebody would want him, even at 28, to come in and be the offensive coordinator. And he said it's good for him that he's not coming in to be the primary play caller. So it gives him some time, gives him a little margin, a little less on his plate to acclimate to that role. But whether it was Sean Payton or Dan Campbell, or I think there's somebody else that I'm drawing a blank on, but there were several people that talked about what a great Ben Johnson has put together. And Ben Johnson commented on that today too, saying, I wanted the best people. I wasn't going to just take this job and hire my friends. Hire all the guys that I've come up with either in Miami or Detroit or wherever, guy I know. I wanted to bring the guys that had the best reputations, that brought different types of expertise to our equation as far as running the team and preparing game plans.
Yeah, and you could tell he mentioned Chip Kelly, Sean Payton, and also the coaching trees that those guys came from. So I think that's a very valid point, Jason Leisure. We appreciate the time from Indianapolis.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me.
That's right.
Thanks, Jason. That was Jason Leisure of the Sun-Times from the Combine in Indianapolis on this first day. It is time for a segment I have not gotten to introduce.
Oh.
It is time for the very famous segment here on the afternoon show called Ben's Vision. So I'm really excited to see what we have in store. I know Shane and Tanny care about this a lot, so I'm excited to see what Ben's vision is next on this.
Low-carb keto yo-yo diets, GLP-1 injections, but you're never going to lose weight if your liver is clogged with fat. So what can you do? It's simple. Almased. Almased is a natural superfood protein shake that uses natural amino acids and bioactive peptides to help unclog your liver and optimize your metabolism so it's easier to lose weight. And it's been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Join millions who have transformed their lives with Almased. Find out more and see the university studies at almased.com. That's almased.com.
What's up, NBA fans? It's Danny Green here. For those who want an inside look at the league through the eyes of a three-time champion, check out my podcast, Inside the Green Room. New episodes drop every week. Be sure to subscribe to Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
score.
Why should teams draft you?
Because I'm the best edge rusher here.
What makes you the best edge rusher?
Film.
Mulligan Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, the score. That is the voice of Mike Green. He is the pass rusher from Marshall with an interesting backstory.
A little baggage.
And a little bit. And we are delighted to welcome in Kevin Fishbane. Does a great job covering the Bears for The Athletic, covering the draft down at the Combine. And he joins us now on the Score Hotline, brought to you by Aturo, your all-weather tire, aturo.com. Morning, Kevin. How you doing?
Good morning, guys. Happy to be on with you.
Well, we appreciate your time. And a lot going on this week. It's been fun to see the, I'm going to call it the Ben Johnson show, because he's on every show. He's moving through the combine deftly, interviewing with everyone, telling interesting things. The guy, you know, what I love about the guy is he's not someone that just repeats the same information. He answers whatever question you ask him. And sometimes it's a different answer, not a contrary one, but just a deeper answer than he just gave to somebody else. I mean, it's almost like every time he talks, you got to hang on what he's saying.
Yeah, it's funny, too, because we were, I don't know if worried is too strong, but whenever you get one of these offensive guru types who you don't really hear press conferences from, like, our big question is, how's he going to handle all that stuff? And he's been great. I mean, you know, nothing really matters until the games begin, but you know, he's winning everybody over, and you're right. He's giving good quotes, and he's being thoughtful, and you know, I kind of like how confident the guy is. You know, he talks about how important it is for him to just be considered a really good football coach, and that's his goal. And you can see the confidence he has, and he should be confident. He knows that he was the, you know, the number one attraction of the coaching cycle, and he knows he was paid that way. And you know, I'm sure Bears fans are really enjoying kind of a breath of fresh air in terms of not having to kind of decipher what he's saying. And guys, I'll be honest with you, I kind of set an unfair low bar for his first combine press conference, because those are kind of tough. We have to really shout our questions in at him, and it's his first time doing one of those. And I thought maybe he would, you know, not like he's given, you know, giving away the farm, but I thought he was good. He was much better than I expected. So credit to him for getting everybody excited, as we're only, what, 6+ months away from week one.
Kevin, really good story in The Athletic this morning about Mike Green, the Marshall edge rusher who had two sexual assault allegations at Virginia, and he addressed them yesterday, and you talked about whether or not he would drop and how that will affect his draft status. Different situation, but same idea about dropping in the draft. Abdul Carter, another edge rusher at the top of the draft, could be the potential number one overall pick. News last night that he might have a stress fracture in his foot and might require surgery. How do you think those two, how far do you think those two guys will fall in their respective positions, and how surprising was the Carter news specifically?
Yeah, I mean, the Carter news took everyone by surprise, especially because we heard from him in the morning, and then, you know, you hear that in the afternoon. And frankly, David, I wasn't even by his podium in the morning, because I'm thinking, I cover the Bears.
Right.
Like, Abdul Carter's going to be long gone by the time the Bears pick. And, yeah, who, you know, that's going to be an interesting one, because, you know, I think Bears fans probably, if you think back to a certain top 10 pick a decade ago, might have some fears about a stress fracture. And you can think about how far that, you know, how much that could impact him, or maybe he'll be just fine and they figure it out early enough. And, you know, someone who's that talented, who's talked about in the regard of Carter as being a top pick, I'm not sure. And the problem is for this draft, which is, you know, kind of a problem for the Bears, is there's just not enough quarterbacks. Like, this is just not, like, if this was last year's quarterback class, you know, and the Bears already had their guy, they'd be in great shape right now. I mean, they're still in great shape. They've got 3 picks in the top 41. But it would be nice for them if Jackson Dart just has a phenomenal next month or two, so that somebody falls in love with him. Because, and that's going to impact Abdul Carter as well, because, you know, if you're one of those teams at the top, would you rather a guy who is as explosive and dominant at a premium position like him, and you take the chance that he's going to be ready to go? Because if you know, because there just aren't that many stars. There aren't many sure things from what the draft prognosticators say about this year's class.
And I don't think the Bears should be star hunting. I really believe that the first three picks of this draft, all those good top 41 players, they got to get line of scrimmage. They got to get the trenches. They need offensive linemen. They need defensive linemen. And I think that, like, we'll have an argument about Ashton Jeanthe or whomever it is. I don't think they have the luxury. I think they've got to build from within, from inside, close to the ball. And I don't think they have a choice about that. And frankly, I think they should do the same thing in free agency.
Yeah, and the thing is about the Jeanthe situation is they have too many holes in the offensive line for you to say, well, if they sign these two guards, they'll be good to go draft Jeanthe. They still need a tackle and a center. So, you know, I think that the Jeanthe thing's an interesting thought exercise because you have Ben Johnson, who saw what a dynamic running back did for his offense in Detroit. You have Ryan Poles, who was part of a Super Bowl team that used running backs from wherever to be great in Kansas City. So, like, I'd be curious those conversations. But yeah, I mean, this thing, like, the next 2 months for the Bears, it just has to be all about building up both lines. And I think that, you know, the one impact that we could see from free agency vis-a-vis the draft is if they do sign those, you know, two big name offensive linemen.
Right.
You know, I wonder how much that leans them toward trying to get that edge rusher with that first pick in the draft, and if they're more comfortable doing that, and then you know you have those two picks in the second round, and again, you know, you guys know every there's 32 different draft boards, and every draft expert has his own draft board. But if you look at some of these, you know, if you look at some of these experts, and you guys know, I mean, Dane Brugler is my colleague; he does a phenomenal job.
Oh, great.
There's a lot of really good offensive linemen he has ranked in that 30 to 45 range. So the Bears could certainly come out with a starter or two in round two as well.
Yeah, that's why everybody needs to keep an open mind because things will be changing and also depending on free agency. In your scenario, that's why I don't want to say a hard no to the idea of Jeanthe on February 27th because if they do rebuild their offensive line through free agency and you're sitting there, I think Ben Johnson's voice is going to be the one that is heard the loudest in that draft room. And if he says and thinks that that's the highest guy on their board and he can do with the running back, there's some draft nicks.
But this is a running back draft. You might get a guy in the third round.
But Ashton Jeanthe might be a guy who's the top guy on your board. I've seen some guys where he's in the top five of players evaluated in this draft class. But I just don't want to say no right now.
But right now, you know what he'd be if he was drafted into this team? Tackled is the word. Because who's blocking for him?
But you ignored what I just said to begin that conversation.
I know what you're
saying. If you have the free agency address, if you address the right side of the line in free agency, you got a different mindset, Kevin, going into the draft.
No, I think you do. And look, guys, I talk a lot about this window the Bears have, and any team has. Like, these aren't 8 to 10 year windows anymore when you're drafting guys. I mean, you have to look at this if you're the Bears, that you have the next really 3 years to strike. And if Caleb Williams turns out to be a star, you obviously feel great about whatever contract you have to give him, and you make it work. And if he's a star like Josh Allen, it doesn't matter how much money he's making, you're going to continue to be competitive. That's the best case scenario. But if you look at Ashton Jeanthe, David, to your point, like, you're looking at this 3-4 year window, which is when Ashton Jeanthe is going to be at his best. This is when he's going to be a phenomenal NFL player, you would think, in these first couple years of his career, and go ahead and strike. But, you know, that's where, you know, and Ryan Poles was asked if he preferred the flip it, where the draft comes first and free agency comes second, like we see in the NBA. And, you know, then these conversations. I always think back, guys, you know, I think it was 10 years ago, we spent all Combine and Senior Bowl talking about linebackers. It was Vic Fangio's second year. You knew he needed linebackers for his 3-4 defense. So we're at the Combine. We're talking to all these linebackers. We're watching them do their Combine drills. Then free agency starts, and what do the Bears do? They sign Danny Trevathan and Jarrell Freeman. And that's like, okay, well, so much for all that time spent watching these linebackers and trying to figure out which one the Bears are going to take. So, you know, free agency could change everything. And in this case, yeah, if you feel really good about the offensive line, I think that opens to me, right. Free agency, a lot of it is how flexible can it make you in the draft? If you can sign all these guys, maybe trade for somebody, you want to really be as flexible as you can with that 10th pick to just add a really, really good player.
What would you do with the guys currently out of contract and heading to free agency? I mean, I keep telling David I'd like to see Matt Pryor brought back as a depth piece. You know, give him another one-year deal. See if the guy can fill in at guard or tack or wherever you need him. He seems like the kind of guy that can do pretty well for himself. I thought he had a good year.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think that's an easy decision for the Bears. Now, I think Matt Pryor is an example of something we're seeing in the NFL now where, you know, it's for so long it was you're a starting offensive lineman or you're not. And that was how the contracts were. But I feel like Matt Pryor is kind of this middle class that is somebody who you might not sign him to be your week one starter, but you know he's probably going to start five games for you, possibly at two to three different positions. And he showed that versatility last year, and I think that could be rewarded. And you could reward that without really hurting your bank account. So, I mean, it is interesting that the Bears – I mean, it's a good thing, I guess, because the Bears don't have to worry about signing a lot of their own, that we're talking about Matt Pryor as the guy that makes the most sense of the unrestricted free agents. But you're right, Mel. I mean, he proved his worth, and he's the type of guy that, you know, you would want to bring back because he can fill in at four different spots on your line.
What's the most surprising thing you heard from Ben Johnson this week?
Most surprising thing? I kind of thought, as I said earlier, that he was pretty open with us, and just that in itself I thought was a little surprising. And, you know, when he talks about Caleb Williams' off-schedule stuff, and I wrote about this that day, David, when you hear coaches lot of players off schedule stuff for a quarterback, you kind of go, uh-oh, like, is that his, you don't want that.
Right.
You want his best attribute to be like, oh, you know, something else. But I appreciated, you know, and I also found it surprising just because of the era we're in, that Ben Johnson goes, this is what quarterbacks do now. And it just reminded you that he's not going to make Caleb Williams something Caleb Williams is not. And he's going to come in here and say, this is something you do that very few guys on the planet can do. And I'm going to get the best out of it. And Caleb Williams could be a progression thrower in the pocket. Like, he's capable of it, but it's not necessarily where he's best. And I was interested to hear the way Ben Johnson explained that. And it was a little surprising because, again, you don't hear coaches say that very often and say it in a way that Ben Johnson did. Yeah, this guy is so good when it's off schedule. He's so good when he's creative. And if you feel good about Ben Johnson, you should feel good that he's going to, you know, take that trait and make sure it works out well for the Bears' offense.
He got the Lions' offense to number one in the NFL. How long does it take to do that here?
I mean, what's it been? Well, like 70 years, right? Was it 1956?
When did they first use the T formation? I'll never forget the way they thrilled the nation.
It might take a couple years. I keep going back to this idea. And when you talk to people around the league about Ben Johnson, one of the things they always emphasize is he's going to put these guys in good position to succeed. And you know, you hear that a lot, and it sounds obvious because it's what coaches are supposed to do. But the Bears haven't had guys who actually do it, especially on that side of the football.
Right.
So I'm very intrigued to see when he's sitting there watching Roma Dunze, when he's watching DJ Moore, when he's watching Cole Kmet, who we all know was underutilized last year, or when he's watching whatever other tight end he wants to bring in, like all these different things. If it's an Ashton Jeanke, if it's a Caleb Johnson, like, you just feel good that this guy is going to create an offense that is going to look a lot better than anything we've seen in the city in a while. And so, you know, I still want to give it a few years because it's, as I said, right now they're at once every three quarters of a century. So we've got, so it might be a bit.
Great stuff, Kevin.
Great stuff, Kevin. Thanks.
All right, take care, guys.
That is Kevin Fishbane from The Athletic. That is great stuff. I really enjoyed that conversation.
And Illinois is going to snap that three-game skid with a 20-point win here over the Iowa Hawkeyes. Brad Underwood is going to be much happier.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. Always fun to talk to the Illini head coach. Brad Underwood joins us now on the Score Hotline, brought to you by Aturo, your all-weather tire, aturo.com. Good morning, Coach. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Good morning.
Nice win. Congratulations on the win over Iowa. You made some adjustments with the starting lineup. Are you guys physically feeling better? I mean, I know the flu went through the team and there was an illness, and that was a tough stretch there trying to get through that.
Yeah, that's an understatement. yeah, we're as healthy. Merez Johnson's still out with the fractured wrist. He's on the mend, but just literally in terms of the health, and I hope the flu's run its course. It was, you know, we've had seven guys with it, so
wow.
It's and it wasn't just it wasn't the 24-hour variety. It was, you know, the bad stuff. So yeah, we're as healthy as we've been, and the important piece is we've got guys with some energy and then guys able to practice, so we can actually make some changes and try to get better.
You had the flu and you had the virus go through your team. That had to be physically challenging. You had the loss last Saturday in New York, which had to be mentally challenging just to get past that, Coach. What does it say about your team that you responded by beating Iowa the way that you did, and how did that make you feel about what's ahead in March?
Well, I think New York was the perfect storm. That was, one, they're good, and secondly, it's just the end of five games in 13 days with the Iowa game, not practicing, not having guys, not being able to truly get better. But we did a lot of good things in that game. We just didn't shoot it very well. But it was, I've said many times, I love coaching this team. This team is so receptive to learning. They're great listeners. And we came back. We got home at 2:30 in the morning. We were on the court at 2:00 in the afternoon. And, you know, it was either that point of, okay, I know we need some rest, but we also have to make some changes. And mm-hmm. we have Thomas Lobb in practice now. He's as, in as good a place as he's been with the mono and then the flu. And so we went wholesale. We went 2.5, almost 3 hours on Sunday in practice and made some pretty substantial changes for this point of the season. But we've been trying to do that for a month. We just couldn't do it. We just didn't feel it was right to try to do it. And our guys picked up on it. Iowa's one of the best offensive teams in the country, and we held them to 61 points. So, you know, some things worked, but it's a tribute to our guys and their ability to stay connected and stay focused.
Obviously, Michigan up next. I you know, I'm not watching every game in the Big Ten, but it seems like every time I turn on my TV, someone's launching a shot with the buzzer going off and knock it down. I mean, the Michigan State full core, whatever that thing was.
What a week.
It's been crazy watching your conference.
Well, the league's the best it's been in my 8 years. You know, top to bottom. And, you know, it's one of those leagues that on any single night you can, no matter who's in, who's out, if there's an injury, if you can go lose. And, you know, you look at everybody's gone through a little spell. You know, Michigan State lost 3 of 4, you know, went out to the LA schools and got beat. And, you know, it's just an incredibly well-coached league. The league has really good players. The freshmen in this league are exceptional, but it is a night in and night out, and of course the venues are just so tough to play. So, yeah, you're going to see, you know, you could literally see anybody win that Big Ten tournament.
Coach, I think one of the more intriguing players to come onto the scene in the Big Ten this year has been your guy, Kasperis Jakučionis. Where did you find him? How impressed have you been by him, and what is his ceiling?
Yeah, his ceiling's untouched. You know, I think the world is a pretty small place when it comes to basketball, and in today's stuff. And we watch a lot of EuroLeague games. I've literally got staff over there every month, We're recruiting over there. We're watching the kids as early as the age of 16. So he's been on the radar for a long time. As soon as the season was over last year, made a quick trip over there. I watched him in a tournament that was loaded field. It was tremendous young players. You know, we had been recruiting him, but it really stepped up at that point. You know, Thomas Love is a guy, again, who's been on the scene for a long time. With the changes in NIL, that those guys have become much more available to universities. So he's been incredible to coach. He's a student of the game. He's just turned 18. He's really young. But his ceiling is extremely high. He hasn't touched it yet.
You know, it's kind of wild to think about the season that you guys have had. And as you say, the Big Ten being as good as it is, do you think that the NCAA committee will take that all into account and put all of that into perspective as they prepare, you know, as you guys come down to it? I mean, you know, you have the flu run through your team. You have a bad loss against Duke. I think that's all understandable, provided everyone is well aware of that.
Yeah, we're 20 in the net ranking.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we've played just as hard and challenging a schedule. We played, you know, four or five SEC teams. You know, so we play people in the non-league. The Duke game didn't hurt us. As crazy as that sounds, it's a loss, but you know, we didn't move in the net. And the net's what is the tournament uses. You play people so that you can keep your net ranking very high, and you're going to play, and as good as our league is, you know, it's going to be a 10 to 12, 13 bid league. And when you play quality opponents every night, you're going to get beat. And so it's not about the losses as much as it is continuing to get better. It's been a challenging year. I think that, you know, when you lose one of your two best players for extended time, like we did with Mono, and then he comes back, I think all of that stuff falls into play and consideration. But, you know, it's why you play competitive people in the non-league, and know that, you know, we got a top 15 offense. We took some hits defensively. We're getting better in that area because we've been top 40 most of the year. So now it's, you know, it's just analytics. It's about continuing to grow and get healthy. And you know, as you move it in tournament time, anything can happen.
Well, we saw that last year with your team, Coach, and I think when you look at how you needed to rebuild your roster and maybe take, I don't know, was it a different approach offensively with this group this season? And, you know, you're shooting a ton of threes. Sometimes they don't always make a ton of threes, and that's, we see that with the Bulls. You know, that's a change in style. You got to get hot to make that worth that change in style. So how different are you this year heading into March than maybe the team you had a year ago?
Oh, well, first of all, we got 10 new guys, and last year we were one of the oldest teams in the country. This year we're the youngest, and, you know, at the A4 level, and we're extremely young. And to play differently, yes. Everybody worries about whether the ball goes in or not. I don't. We're one of the top two-point field goal shooting teams in the country. We get that because we shoot threes. The thing that we've done has been offensive rebound, and you know, it's you got to go chase your misses. You got to get more opportunities. For us, it's a little bit about math and being able to do it, play percentages, you know, and water always finds its level. And you know, in games where we've made threes, we're one of the only teams in the country to make more than 15 threes in four different games. So you know, it's been really good to us. We're a top 15 team with all of the adjustments, and not having Caspers for two games, not having Tommy for multiple games. So, you know, we're different, yes, and we've been different on the defensive side. We've just had to make some tweaks on that.
When you talk about the tournament coming up, and obviously the Big Ten tournament is what matters, and you can determine your fate there as well, your fate, excuse me. But when you talk about conferences, you say the Big Ten's been as good as it is. We keep hearing the SEC say they need to get 14 teams in, which seems insane.
They probably should.
But that's
they
what I was going to say. They are really good top to bottom. How do you project how many Big Ten teams need to be in? It seems like the league, as you mentioned, has been sensational throughout the year.
Yeah, and I think in these super conferences, there's no doubt we've seen the SEC, and we scrimmaged Ole Miss in an exhibition, and it's that league's good, and we've played four of the better teams in that league, so that is a very, very old league. All the top teams in there are very, very old, so they're I think they're very good, but the Big Ten's second. And it's you look. We had an incredible non-conference schedule and a ton of success in non-league games, and I think you reward that. And when you're playing quad one and quad two games every night, you are going to get beat some. And it's not about the wins and losses as much as it is just the competitive balance of your league. And we had Minnesota who goes out west and beats the two LA schools, and it's just Penn State's had some injuries and they're playing better. They just go on the road and win in Minnesota. Anybody can beat anybody, and that helps our league. And I don't think we have we don't have any real bad losses and league wise, and that helps. And I think it's at least a 10, 12, 13 bid league, and it's much more than wins and losses. It's about the computers and the nets and the analytics behind it.
Great stuff, Coach. Thanks a ton. Great catching up with you.
Best
really
of luck, Coach.
It. Yeah.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Dan Bernstein, Marshall Harris, the Bernstein and Harris Show, middays 10 till 2 on 670 The Score.
There's some big news that we were discussing yesterday, and the aftershocks continue as the investigations continue. I am amazed. I am awestruck at how little traction the story has gotten. And maybe my cynicism can't rise to the occasion, but I hope that's not the case. This is some special work that was done by a couple of award-winning writers in Michael Rosenberg and our next guest, Pat Forty, who is a Sports Illustrated senior writer. He's on Twitter at @ByPatForty, and he is with us now on the Circa Sports Illinois hotline. Download the Circa Sports app today, twitch.tv/Chicago670. The Score. Pat, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Hey, doing well, guys. Happy to be on with you.
This was the story just kept going. It just keeps going, and I'm reading it. And I'm like, wow. And then all of a sudden, there's the murder of somebody in a witness protection program, and also, how did you just? I want to talk about the process first. Like, when you realized the size of this, how did you and Mike and your editors just kind of get your arms around how to proceed?
Well, it's a good question. It's been a gradual process. You know, I've kind of been working on this story for almost exactly a year, going back to when the Temple UAB betting line went crazy on March 7th, 2024, and started hearing then that there had been a lot of scrutiny of Temple and that this might be kind of an organized game-fixing, point-shaving situation. The Jonte Porter stuff on the NBA level came out, and in the after effects of that, you started hearing there's a connection between what's going on in the NBA and what's going on in college. And the NBA right now is still isolated to Jonte Porter. They're investigating Terry Rozier for a game in 2023 as well that they think might be linked, but there's nothing been proven in that area. But the college stuff kind of keeps coming, and so through the course of the fall, I kept hearing more and more about this, and we start looking into it. And then when Shane Hennon, one of the two people we wrote about, was arrested in mid-January, Some people started pointing and saying, that guy is involved with the Porter stuff, and we think might be involved with the college stuff as well. And you start asking around and learn about Marvis Fairley as well, and all of a sudden the dots start to connect. Still, there's, you know, nobody has been charged with anything in the college game yet, but the investigations are certainly underway.
Pat, I'm just curious because I'm almost a little surprised. Call me a skeptic, but I'm surprised it's taken this long for something of this magnitude to happen, given how sports gambling has become legal in so many different places in this country, and it's as easy as, you know, pulling up an app, as you know, on your phone, whatever. Have there ever been enough safeguards to think that this isn't where we were eventually going to end up?
Yeah, no, there aren't. And historically, look, this happens every, I don't know, couple of decades or so. If you go back to CCNY in the 1950s, right, and going on from there, you can find Tulane, Boston College, Arizona State.
Northwestern,
absolutely. So this is kind of the next cycle of it. But to your point, yes, it's much easier for people to gamble. It's legal in a lot of places. You can do it on your phone. I think on college campuses, it's rampant. And so college athletes are around it a lot. They're not supposed to be doing it, but are they not doing it or not? You know, are they? So that's kind of the question there. And yeah, I mean, you turn on a game, you go to a website, you go to SI.com, there's advertising from gambling outfits there. And so it's much more pervasive now. And no, I don't think people are terribly shocked that something like this is transpiring.
It makes me sick to my stomach that I have to ask you this, but I'm just being honest about where my thoughts have gone. If the Justice Department is now being run by somebody who we know is in large part in league with some of these nefarious forces and in line with people who are making all the money, and has basically said that the Justice Department would be used now to go after enemies of the oligarchy, why should we think that these investigations and prosecutions would continue with any sort of with rhyme or reason?
It's a legitimate question. I mean, with the changeover in administrations and in various agencies, I think everything is up for grabs, including where this investigation may go. I wouldn't rule out the fact that, you know, somebody may just come and say, you know what, we're not very interested in this.
That's what I mean. Like, the right phone call is made for somebody who is got some international skin in this game. It's like, hey, guys, you're getting a little too close. This is too much heat. Knock it off.
I mean, it's not out of the question. Oh. We'll see, you know, and again, you know, one of the things that obviously we knew going in, but has been reinforced with, the feds don't tell us what they're up to. Right. So we don't know for sure what stages these investigations are in, and they may go dormant. Who knows? It's not impossible to see that scenario happening. The NCAA is a different deal, you know, and we're pretty sure that they're active on several of these fronts, but that's not the same as putting criminal charges on somebody.
So I'm glad you brought up the NCAA, because if the Department of Justice, you're right, they don't show up until the case is basically over, because they don't even bother you until they have all the evidence that they need. Historically, that's been the case. The NCAA, meanwhile, what's interesting to me about this at this current time, Pat, it seems like they're maybe the weakest they've ever been as an organization to kind of regulate what goes on. We've seen it with college football and who really calls the shots there. And now college basketball. I remember early on there was some college baseball stuff that came out with the gambling stuff, and teams, I believe, in the SEC got pinched a little bit on that. But are we to believe that the NCAA has the teeth to really get in here and regulate like what we need to be seen, whether that's the punishments? I'm just at a loss for how involved the NCAA might be going forward with this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they are involved because, for one thing, it's easier now, quite frankly. And that's how the baseball guys you brought up got nailed, because the gambling monitors know what everybody's doing.
That's one of the dumbest crimes of all time. The baseball thing is hilarious.
Oh, yeah. How bad it was. You know, that was summer of 2023. Yes. And, well, like, you're laughing. Like, this cannot be real. Right. These guys are not that dumb, at least that we've seen yet. They're reckless. but they're not that dumb. The NCAA's got all of this, the algorithms, the analytics, the who's betting on what, where, on how much at their disposal, so they can figure out where are unusual bets happening and on which teams. And you know, you can go in and at least demand cell phone data from players and coaches and see if you've been talking to these alleged game fixers. Now, does that prove that you were fixing games? Not necessarily, but if you've been in contact with them, that gives them something to go on. There's more information available to make a case now than there probably ever has been from a gambling perspective.
Are talking with Sports Illustrated senior writer Pat Forty here on the Bernstein and Harris show. And another theme that I took away from this is the first half spread bet. And this idea of maybe you find some of these vulnerable college players who aren't listening to your entreaties. Like, I don't want to go against my team. We're trying to win. And say, hey, well, you can still try to win. It's just the first half spread that we're not worried about the outcome of the game. And that gives, it's not even plausible deniability, but it's maybe some sort of ethical or moral alleviation of cognitive dissonance in the eyes of a player to say, no, at no point did I not try to win the game.
Alleviation of cognitive dissonance is way too good a phrase for talk show here. That's very well said. That you're right. That I think maybe the ethical conflict is a little less if you just tell players, you know what? Give us 20 minutes. That's all we're asked for. Next, the second half, go all out, win the game. And, that way you're not literally trying to make your team lose. You're just adding to the degree of difficulty of winning. That's obviously maybe not in reality true, but that can be the sell job to players. And the other part of it here that I find insidious is, you know, look at the teams that we're talking about. We are talking so far. Temple is a high-profile team compared to Eastern Michigan, compared to North Carolina A&T, compared to Mississippi Valley State, University of New Orleans. We're talking about the lowest level of Division I, where there's not money for NIL. There's not a lot of money even for scholarships and for training table and expenses and all the other things that come with it. And so you want to appeal to those players and say, hey, you know what? Look at the guys, you know, Kansas and North Carolina and Kentucky, what they get. You don't get anything. Here's a way you can get a little something. Give us a half. You know, I think that they've preyed upon the poorest and smallest levels of Division I here.
It's really the others, as you mentioned, you know, the high majors and the basketball powers that be, that makes more sense. How concerned are you that this is going to be a problem going forward with other sports? Basketball seems like an easy target because of, as Dan mentioned, the first half nature of the things you can do. But
and fewer players, the game can be affected easier.
Yeah, the game can be affected. Any other sports that kind of pique your interest to see, would they try to take advantage of a different sport in different levels, Pat?
You know, I just don't think there's enough available wagering. Like, there's football and there is some baseball, as we learned. I didn't even know there was college baseball wagering until I was doing that story on the Alabama case there. But it's too hard, I think, in football. You would need massive complicity from half of a starting unit. And even then, you're not sure you're going to get it. And one of the things that was pointed out to me here is, like, at a lot of these places, it's multiple players that are being suspended in basketball. Like, you get one out of the starting five, that may not be enough to fix a game. So you may need to enlist two or three guys in order to try to make it happen. So I just think numerically, it's difficult. And, you know, if there were wagering on college tennis or gymnastics or things like that, then I would be concerned. But to my knowledge, there isn't.
That's, they always said boxing is the easiest sport to fix because you just had to get to the one person. Now, have you tracked down Hysier Miller? Have you talked with him?
Haven't talked to him. Talked to people close to him. He's in Germany playing professionally. From what I've gathered, he maintains he did not ever try to influence the outcome of a game. So that's his stance. And, you know, we haven't heard from him, like via NCAA interview or a legal transcript or anything yet. So his story remains largely untold. But, you know, unfortunately for him, he's the one name out there that's really been associated with all of this.
Well, here is to whatever is next for this report you're reporting. And it's really my hope. I'm just kind of standing, looking around like the John Travolta meme. Like, where is everybody? As it, maybe I keep thinking I'm crazy that this is such a huge deal and nobody wants to kind of pick it up and try to follow you guys into the breach here.
Well, we're fine to keep doing it ourselves.
Okay.
ESPN and the Wall Street Journal have done some reporting on it and some good reporting as well. But the more territory is left for Sports Illustrated, the more we'll take.
Go get them. Pat Forty, thanks so much.
Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
That is Pat Forty of Sports Illustrated. He and Michael Rosenberg were doing some of this, the reporting on, like you say, massive multi-million-dollar international sports gambling scandal that exists right now.
Full with the goons and the murders and everything,
everything
else.
Everything. Yeah, everything. It's all right here. I mean, the movie rights should be optioned.
That's what I was about to say. They will right? be making at least a limited series or whatever out of this.
Hey, we got something really good coming out of the combine. The NFL is actually doing something good and right that is going to make the game better, more equitable, more watchable, all of it. We'll explain next.